Edward Rushton was the radical, campaigning, blind poet of Liverpool. His life spanned the 18th and 19th centuries at the time of the slave trade, of revolution, and of social upheaval. Forgotten Hero, written by Bill Hunter and narrated by George Sefton, is his story.
Chapter 18, The Fire of English Liberty. The blind radical poet saw the history of England in terms of a struggle to return to lost liberties, going back to the beginning of English history when he believed that kings or chiefs were elected. His poem, Superstition, makes plain this view.
In early days, if kings were made by men, and that they were, and still should be the light of nature shows. How comes it then that the earth is filled with slaves? How comes it then that man, this reasoning thing, this being with such faculties endowed, this being formed to trace the great first cause through many a wondrous path, how comes it then that he in every clime should cringe, should crouch, should bend the imploring eye and trembling knee to mere self-raised oppressors? Heavens, to think that not a tithe of all the sons of men e'er kissed thy sacred cup, O Liberty, to find where e'er imagination roves, millions on millions prostrate in the dust.
Rushton's poem, The Fire of English Liberty, denounced the loss of liberty, beginning with the Norman Conquest.
When o'er this sea-encircled ground the Norman conqueror grimly frowned, and bade his curfew ring, with sullen brow the Saxon hind in the straw couch his limbs consigned, and cursed his tyrant king. And long beneath the oppressor's sway, with scowling eye poor England lay, and quenched were all her fires. Yet thy small spark, O Liberty, e'en then survived each dark decree, and glimmered amongst our sires.
The myth of the freeborn English, with their rights and independence stolen from them by the Norman conquest of 1066, existed through hundreds of years. In fact, the Saxon kings also ruled over a class system. The myth, however, was kept alive because the Norman conquest brought the rule of a more centralized and warlike society, and the reality of the long struggle of the mass of the people to break free of feudal bonds and hold on to protect what was left of their common rights. The historian Doris Mary Stenton puts it that
the Norman invasion was not, like the Saxon or Danish invasions, a national migration. It was an aristocratic conquest led by a man who won a kingdom for himself and distributed estates among his followers. This new aristocracy replaced the English nobility, who had formed the court of the old English kings. It soon came to dominate rural society and local government as well.
William the Conqueror was an autocrat who seized the opportunity of conquest to gain a power new and unprecedented amongst European kings.
The theory that by right all land was the king's, and that land was held by others only at his gift and return for specified service, was new to English thought.
There were repeated rebellions after the Norman conquest. William built castles throughout the kingdom to secure his rule and
expected his greater barons to secure their lands by building castles, their chief places of residence. In this way, by means of royal and baronial castles, the land was pinned down and revolt was hopeless before it had well begun.
It was these struggles then, and the later struggles of common people against tyranny and feudal restrictions, which nourished this notion of the Norman conquest as suppressing the rights of freeborn Englishmen. It was continually referred to when the peasants were resisting the encroachment on the common land. It runs like a thread through the peasant uprisings in the Middle Ages and through the English Revolution of 1640 to 49. In that revolution, the Levellers, who were the backbone of the revolutionary New Model Army, asserted that William the Bastard took the land from the people and gave it to his followers. From whence came all our nobility and gentry, they asked. And they answered, their rise was by cruel murder and theft by the conquest. Their rise was the country's ruin, and the putting them down will be the restitution of our rights again. The Levellers denounced the way that the Norman yoke had been responsible for tyrannous and arbitrary laws, and demanded the abolition of the use of a mixture of French and Latin in legal proceedings, as this was oppression by foreign, un-Englished law. The theory lived right up to the time of the first mass party of the British working class, the Chartist movement. In the Chartist paper, the Northern Star, the 5th June 1841, a poem by William Hick declaimed,
"Oh, where is the justice of old, the spirit of Alfred the Great? Ere the throne was debased by corruption and gold, when the people were one with the state, 'tis gone with our freedom to vote."
Rushton saw the fight for freedom as having made a leap in the English Revolution, but now, in the 18th century, freedom had been lost. His radical sympathies would have been with the Levellers. Of course, official histories have dealt very cursorily with the struggles of the common people, such as the peasants' strivings and revolts. The Levellers, however, knew of the past struggles of the lower classes. There was a Wat Tyler brigade in the Cromwellian army. Wat Tyler had been the leader of the peasant revolution in England in June 1381, over 250 years before. Many of the positions of the Levellers were those of the radicals at the end of the 18th century and of the Chartist movement on suffrage, equal electoral districts and yearly parliaments. Certainly many of the sentiments of the blind Liverpool radical were those of the Levellers, and many of them were expressed with a similar forthrightness. The Levellers' arguments were linked much more to religion and biblical metaphor than those of Rushton. Although he was a nonconformist and had religious friends, his beliefs were based on the rationalism of the radicals of the time. However, it was from the democratic drive given by the Levellers to the Revolutionary Army that he drew his inspiration. They stood, as he did, for religious tolerance. The Levellers were the most consistent revolutionaries and democrats against repression in church and civil affairs. They demanded the vote irrespective of property and clashed with Cromwell and his son-in-law over this in the army debates at Putney and Whitehall. In these debates, Cromwell insisted that a man without property had no responsibility in the country, therefore he could not have the vote. Rushton's Fire of English Liberty says of the English Revolution,
"This sacred fire, through many an age of mental gloom and civil rage, a varied heat bestowed. And when the intrepid Hampden bled, and Charles was numbered with the dead, an awful flame it glowed. This lighted Belgic William o'er, this scared a Stuart from our shore, and showed an abject world with how much ease despotic kings, those foul, inflated, plundering things, may from their thrones be hurled."
He then declares that the fire of English liberty is now being snuffed out.
"Unawed by man's infuriate foes, 'twas thus our sturdy fathers rose and guarded freedom's fire, which we, a mean, degenerate race, corrupt, luxurious, sordid, base, are suffering to expire. Go then, you reprobated few, with souls to freedom ever true, whom tyrants ne'er shall tame. Go, spread the cheerless embers round, and should a few faint sparks be found, oh, fan them into flame."
In this poem, Rushton speaks of 1688 and the scaring of a Stuart from our shore. The awful flame then lighted Belgic William o'er. The agreement which made William of Orange king was not the Glorious Revolution, as it was called by those who gained by it amongst the wealthy merchant and landowning class. These were the upper strata of rulers who had been in the party of the Presbyterians and the right wing of the revolution. They had vacillated in the face of Charles I and his army, and were thrown aside by the independents who put Cromwell in charge of building a new model army. The revolution went too far for these wealthy classes, and they headed the reaction, which brought the Restoration in 1660. When Charles II tried to reassert the old power of the monarchy and cut across their interests, the shire gentry and the town merchants brought over William and Mary as constitutional monarchs in 1668. This faction of the landowners and rich merchants formed a Whig party, which became the dominant party of Britain's rulers through most of the 18th and into the 19th century.